the reduction gears took all the shock. Number one shaft's okay. Some shock damage to the aft bearings. That I can fix myself. Number four screw is damaged, not sure how bad, but we can't turn it without risking the shaft bearings. Starboard rudder's jammed over, but I can deal with that. Another hour, maybe, and it'll be midships. May have to replace it, depending on how bad it looks. We're down to one shaft. We can make 10-11 knots, and we can steer badly. Time to fix. Months, 4 or 5 is my best guess right now, sir. All of which the commander knew would require him to be here, overseeing the yard crews, essentially rebuilding half the ship's power plant, maybe 3/4. He hadn't fully evaluated the damage to number 4 yet. That was when the captain really lost his temper. It was about time, the change thought. If I could launch an airstrike, I'd sink those sons of bitches. But launching anything on the speed generated by a single shaft was an iffy proposition. Besides, it had been an accident, and the skipper really didn't mean it. "You have my vote on that one, sir," Chenge assured him, not really meaning it either, because he added, "Maybe they'll be nice enough to pay for the repairs." His reward was a nod. "We can start moving again?" "Number one shaft is a little out from shock damage, but I can live with it, yes, sir." "Okay, get ready to answer bells. I'm taking this overpriced barge back to Pearl." "Aye, aye, sir." Admiral Mancuso was back in his office reviewing preliminary data on the exercise when his yeoman came in with a signal sheet. "Sir, looks like two carriers are in trouble." "What did they do, collide?" Jones asked, sitting in the corner and reviewing other data. "Worse," the yeoman told the civilian. ComSub Pack read the dispatch. "Oh, that's just great." Then his phone rang. It was the secure line that came directly from Pack Fleet Ops. "This is Admiral Mancuso." "Sir, this is Lieutenant Copps at Fleet Communications. I have a submarine emergency beacon located approximately 31 north, 175 east. We're refining that position now. Code number is for Asheville, sir. There is no voice transmission, just the beacon. I am initiating a sub-miss sub-sunk. The nearest naval aircraft are on the two carriers." Dear God. Not since Scorpion had the U.S. Navy lost a sub, and he'd been in high school then. Mancuso shook his head clear. There was work to be done. "Those two carriers are probably out of business, mister."
"Oh?"
Oddly enough, Lieutenant Copps hadn't heard that yet. "Call the P-3s. I have work to do."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Mancuso didn't have to look at anything. The water in that part of the Pacific Ocean was 3 miles deep, and no fleet submarine ever made could survive at a third of that depth. If there were an emergency, and if there were any survivors, any rescue would have to happen within hours, else the cold surface water would kill them. "Ron, we just got a signal. Asheville might be down."
"Down?"
That word was not one any submariner wanted to hear, even if it was a gentler expression than sunk.
"Frenchie's kid,
and 120 others. What can I do, Skipper?" "Head over to SOSIS and look at the data."
"Aye, aye, sir."
Jones hustled out the door while Subpack lifted his phone and started punching buttons. He already knew that it was an exercise in futility. All Pack Fleet submarines now carry the AN-BST-3 emergency transmitters aboard, set to detach from their ships if they passed through crush depth, or if the quartermaster of the watch neglected to wind the unit's clockwork mechanism. The latter possibility, however, was unlikely. Before the explosive bolts went, the BST made the most god-awful noise to chide the neglectful enlisted man. Asheville was almost certainly dead, and yet he had to follow through in the hope of a miracle. Maybe a few crewmen had gotten off. Despite Mancuso's advice, the carrier group did get the call. A frigate, USS Gary, went at once to maximum sustainable speed and sprinted north toward the area of the beacon, responding as required by the laws of man and the sea. In 90 minutes, she'd be able to launch her own helicopter for a surface search and further serve as a base for other helos to continue the rescue operation if necessary. John Stennis turned slowly into the wind and managed to launch a single S-3 Viking ASW aircraft, whose onboard instruments were likely to be useful for a surface search. The Viking was overhead in less than an hour. There was nothing to be seen on radar except for a Japanese Coast Guard cutter heading in for the beacon about 10 miles out. Contact was established, and the white cutter verified its notice of the emergency radio and intentions to search for survivors. The Viking circled the transmitter. There was a slick of diesel oil to mark the ship's grave, and a few bits of floating debris, but repeated low passes and four sets of eyes failed to spot anything to be rescued. The navy blue prefix on a signal denoted information that would be of interest to the entire fleet, perhaps sensitive in nature, less often highly classified. In this case, it was something too big to be kept a secret. Two of Pacific Fleet's four aircraft carriers were out of business for a long time. The other two, Eisenhower and Lincoln, were in the I.O. and were likely to remain there. Ships know few secrets, and even before Admiral Dubrow got his copy of the dispatch, word was already filtering through his flagship. No chief swore more vilely than the battle force commander, who already had enough to worry about. The same response greeted the signals personnel who informed the senior naval officers on Pentagon duty. Like most intelligence officers in a foreign land in time of danger, Clark and Chavez didn't have a clue. If they had, they would probably have caught the first plane anywhere. Spies have never been popular with anyone, and the Geneva Protocols merely affirmed a rule for time of war, mandating their deaths as soon after apprehension as was convenient, usually by firing squad. Peacetime rules were a little more civilized, but generally with the same end result. It was something CIA emphasized in its recruiting interviews. The international rules of espionage allowed for this unhappy fact by giving as many field intelligence officers as possible diplomatic covers, along with which came immunity from harm. Those were called legal agents, protected by international treaty, as though they really were the diplomats their passports said they were. Clark and Chavez were illegals and not so protected. In fact, John Clark had never once been given a legal cover. The importance of this became clear when they left their cheap hotel for a meeting with Isamu Kimura. It was a pleasant afternoon, made less so by the looks they got as Gaijin. No longer a mixture of curiosity and distaste, now there was genuine hostility. The atmosphere had changed materially since their arrival here, though remarkably, things immediately became more cordial when they identified themselves as Russians, which prompted Ding to speculate on how they might make their cover identity more obvious to passers-by. Unfortunately, civilian clothing did not offer that option, and so they had to live with the looks, generally feeling the way a wealthy American might in a high-crime neighborhood. Kimura was waiting at the agreed-upon place, an inexpensive drinking establishment. He already had a few drinks in him.
"Good afternoon," Clark said pleasantly in English, a beat. "Something wrong?"
"I don't know," Kimura said when the drinks came. There were many ways of speaking that phrase. This way indicated that he knew something.
"There is a meeting of the ministers today. Goto called it. It's been going on for hours. A friend of mine in the defense agency hasn't left his office since Thursday night."
"Da, so?"
"You haven't seen it, have you?"
"The way Goto has been speaking about America."
The MITI official finished off the last of his drink and raised his hand to order another. Service typically was fast. They could have said that they'd seen the first speech, but instead, Clerk asked for Kimura's read on the situation.
"I don't know," the man replied, saying the same thing again while his eyes and tone told a somewhat different story. "I've never seen anything like this. Rhetoric. At my ministry we have been waiting for instructions all week. We need to restart the trade talks with America to reach an understanding, but we have no instructions. Our people in Washington are doing nothing. Goto has spent most of his time with defense, constant meetings, and with his Aibatsu friends. It's not the way things are here at all."
"My friend," Clark said with a smile, his drink now untouched after a single sip,
"you speak as though there is something serious in the air."
"You don't understand. There is nothing in the air. Whatever is going on, Miti is not a part of it."
"And?"
Miti is part of everything here. My minister is there now, finally, but he hasn't told us anything.
Kimura paused. Didn't these two know anything?
Who do you think makes our foreign policy here? Those dolts in the foreign ministry. They report to us.
And the defense agency, who cares what they think about anything? We are the ones who shape our country's policies. We work with the Zaibatsu. We coordinate. We represent business in our relations with other countries and their markets. We make the position papers for the prime minister to give out. That's why I entered the ministry in the first place.
But not now, Clark asked.
Now? Goto is meeting with them himself and spends the rest of his time with people who don't matter, and only now is my minister called in.
Well, yesterday, Kimura corrected himself.
And he's still there.
The man seemed awfully rattled, Chavez told himself, over what seemed to be little more than some bureaucratic turf fighting. The Ministry of International Trade and Industry was being outmaneuvered by someone else, so...
You are upset that the industry leaders meet directly with your prime minister? He asked.
So much and so long. Yes, they're supposed to work through us, but Gota has always been Yamata's lapdog, Kimura shrugged. Perhaps they want to make policy directly now, but how can they do that without us?
Without me, the man means, Chavez thought with a smile. Dumbass bureaucrat. CIA was full of them, too. It wasn't all the way through, but such things never were. Most of the tourists who came to Saipan were Japanese, but not quite all of them. The Pacific Island was a good place for a lot of things. One of them was deep-sea fishing, and the waters here were not as crowded as those around Florida and the Gulf of California. Pete Burrows was sunburned, exhausted, and thoroughly satisfied with an 11-hour day at sea. It was just the perfect thing, the computer engineer told himself, sitting in the fighting chair and sipping a beer, to get a person over a divorce. He'd spent the first 2 hours getting offshore, then 3 hours trolling, then 4 hours fighting against the biggest goddamn albacore tuna he'd ever seen. The real problem would be convincing his fellow workers that it wasn't a lie. The monster was too big to mount over his mantle, and besides, his ex had the house on the fireplace. He'd have to settle for a photo, and everyone knew the stories about that, damn it. Blue screen technology had reached fishermen. For $20, you can have your choice of monster fish hanging from its electronic tail behind you. Now, if he'd caught a shark, he could have taken home the jaw and teeth, but an albacore, magnificent as it was just tuna fish. Well, what the hell, his wife hadn't believed his stories about the late nights at work either, the bitch. Good news, bad news. She didn't like fishing either, but now he could fish all he wanted, maybe even fish for a new girl. He popped open another beer. The marina didn't look very busy for a weekend. The main port area was, though, 3 big commercial ships, ugly ones, he thought, though he didn't know exactly what they were on first sight. His company was in California, though not close to the water, and most of his fishing was of the freshwater sort. This trip had been a life's ambition. Tomorrow maybe he'd get something else. For the moment he looked left at the albacore, had to be at least 700 pounds, nowhere close to the record, but one hell of a lot bigger than the monster salmon he'd gotten the year before with his trusty Ted Williams spinning rig. The air shook again, spoiling his moment with his fish. The overhead shadow announced another goddamn 747 coming out of the airport. It wouldn't be long before this place was spoiled, too. Hell, it already was. About the only good news was that the Japanese who came here to kick loose and screw Filipina bar girls didn't like to fish much. The boat's skipper brought them in smartly. His name was Oreza, a retired Master Chief Quartermaster, U.S. Coast Guard. Burroughs left the fighting chair, headed topside, and sat down next to him.
Get tired of talking to your fish?
Don't like drinking alone, either.
Oreza shook his head. Not when I'm driving.
Bad habit from the old days?
The skipper nodded. Yeah, I guess. I'll buy you one at the club, though. Nice job on the fish. First time, you said?
First time in blue water, Burroughs said proudly.
Could have fooled me, Mr. Burroughs.
Pete, the engineer corrected.
Pete, Oreza confirmed.
Call me Portugee.
You're not from around here. New Bedford, Massachusetts, originally. Winters are too cold. I served here once a long time back. There used to be a Coast Guard station down at Punta Arenas, closed now. The wife and I liked the climate, liked the people, and hell, the competition statewide for this sort of business is too stiff, Oreza explained. What the hell, the kids are all grown. So, anyway, we ended up coming out here. You know how to handle a boat pretty well. Portugee nodded. I ought to. I've been doing it 35 years, more if you count going out with my pop. He eased to port, coming around Manyagaha Island. The fishing out of New Bedford's going to hell, too. What are those guys? Burroughs asked, pointing to the commercial port. Car carriers. When I came in this morning, they were moving jeeps out of that one, the skipper shrugged. More goddamn cars. You know, when I came here, it was kind of like Cape Cod in the winter. Now it's more like the Cape in the summer. All the goddamn war. Portugee shrugged. More tourists made for more crowding, spoiling the island, but also bringing him more business. Expensive place to live? Getting that way, Oreza confirmed. Another 747 flew off the island. That's funny. What? That one didn't come out of the airport. What do you mean? That one came out of Kobla. It's an old sack runway, Buff Field. Buff? Big ugly fat fucker, Portugee explained. B-52s. There's 5 or 6 runways in the islands that can take big birds. Dispersal fields from the bad old days, he went on. Kobler's right next to my old Loran station. I'm surprised they still keep it up. Hell, I didn't know they did, even. I don't understand. There used to be a strategic air command base on Guam. You know, nukes, all that big shit. In case the crap hit the fan, they were supposed to disperse off Anderson Air Force Base, so one missile couldn't get them all. There's 2 big bird runways on Saipan, the airport and Kobler. 2 more on Tinian, leftovers from World War II, and 2 more on Guam. They're still good to use. No reason why not, Oreza's head turned. We don't get many hard freezes here to rip things up. The next 747 came off Saipan International, and in the clear evening sky, they could see yet another coming in from the eastern side of the island. This place always this busy? No, most I've ever seen. Goddamn hotels must be packed solid. Another shrug. Well, that means the hotels will be interested in buying that fish off you. How much? Enough to cover the charter, Pete. That's one big fish you brought in. But tomorrow you have to get lucky again. Hey, you find me another big boy like our friend down there, and I don't care what you charge. I love it when people say that. Oreza eased back on the throttles as he approached the marina. He aimed for the main dock. They needed the hoist to get the fish off. The albacore was the 3rd largest he'd ever brought in, and this Burroughs guy wasn't all that bad a charter. You make a living at this? Portugee nodded. With my retirement pay, yeah, it's not a bad life. 30-some years I drove uncle's boats, and now I get to drive me own. And she's paid for. Burroughs was looking at the commercial ships now. He lifted the skipper's binoculars. You mind? Strap around your neck, if you don't mind. Amazing that people thought the strap was some sort of decoration. Sure, Burroughs did that, adjusting the focus for his eyes, and examining Orchid Ace. Ugly damn things. Not made to be pretty, made to carry cars. Oreza started the final turn in. That's no car. Looks like some kind of construction thing. Bulldozer, like. Oh? Portugee called for his mate, the local kid, to come topside and work the lines. Good kid, 15, might try for the Coast Guard and spend a few years learning the trade properly. Oreza was working on that. The Army have a base here? Nope, the Air Force and Navy still have some folks down on Guam, but not even much there anymore. There, he killed his throttles and the Springer drifted to a halt, just perfect. Again, Oreza thought, as always, taking pleasure from doing a seaman's job just so. A man on the dock turned the crank to swing the hoist over his fantail, giving a thumbs up when he saw the size of the fish. Watching to see that the boat was tied up properly, Oreza sat back, killed his engines, and thought about the evening's first beer. Here, have a look, Burroughs handed the glasses over.
Portugee turned in his chair and readjusted the binoculars to his eyes before training them in on the car carrier down the coast. He knew how the ships were arranged. He'd done safety inspection on them while on shore duty with the Coast Guard. He'd inspected this very ship, in fact, one of the first built for the purpose automobile ferries designed to carry trucks and other cargo as well as private cars. Some of the decks had a lot of overhead.
What?
You know what it is?
No.
It was a tracked vehicle. It was in shadows because the sun was low in the sky, but the paintwork was definitely dark, and it had a large box of some sort on the back. Then something clicked. It was some kind of missile launcher. He remembered seeing them on TV during the Persian Gulf War, just before his retirement. Oreza stood to get a slightly better angle. There were two others in the parking lot.
Okay, I got it. Some sort of exercise, Burroughs said, heading down the ladder to the main deck.
See, that's a fighter plane over there. My cousin used to fly it before he went with American. It's an F-15 Eagle, Air Force bird.
Oreza turned the glasses and caught the fighter circling. Sure enough, there were two of them flying in a nice, tight military formation. F-15 Eagle fighters circling the center of the island in a classic display of protection for one's native soil. Except for one thing. The national emblem on the wings was a solid red circle.
Again, Jones preferred the paper printouts to an electronic display. The latter was better for live action, but on high-speed playback got the eyes tired too fast, and this was a job that demanded care. Lives might depend on it, he told himself, already thinking that was a lie. Two senior chief oceanographic technicians went through the pages with him. They started with midnight and had to check carefully. The submarine exercise area off Koori Atoll had been chosen for its proximity to a series of hydrophones, part of the Pacific SOSIS system. The near array was one of the last ever implanted and was the size of a garage or small house. Actually part of a mega array, it was electronically linked to another installation 50 nautical miles away. But that one was older, smaller, and less capable. A cable that linked them both, leading first to Koori, then to Midway, where there was a satellite uplink to back up the cable that led all the way to Pearl Harbor. The ocean was, in fact, crisscrossed with such cables. For quite some time during the Cold War, the U.S. Navy had laid almost as much as Bell Telephone, occasionally chartering the latter's ships for the task.
Okay. Here's Kuroshio snorting, Jones said, circling the black marks in red.
How the hell did you ever beat Masker? One of the chiefs asked in surprise.
Well, it is a good system, but you ever really listen to it?
I haven't been at sea in 10 years, the senior chief replied.
When I was on Dallas, we played games with Moosebrugger for a week, down at Autech in the Bahamas.
The Moose has a big rep.
And it's a no-shit rep, too. We couldn't hold her. She couldn't hold us. It was a real mother.
Jones went on, speaking now not like a civilian contractor with a doctorate, but like the proud sonar man he'd been, and he realized still was.
They had a helicopter pilot who was giving us fits, too. Anyway, he flipped another page. Then I figured it out. Masker sounds like rain hitting the surface, like a spring shower. Not real noisy. But the freaks are unique. You can get a good cut on them. Then I realized all we had to do was see what the topside weather was like. If it's blue sky and you hear rain bearing 020, that's the guy. It was clear yesterday northwest of Koori. I checked with fleet weather before I came over.
The senior chief nodded and smiled.
I'll remember that one, sir.
Okay, we have the Jap here at midnight. Now let's see what else we can find. He flipped forward to the next fanfold page. Had circumstances been different, he might have seen it as a paper slinky, one of his new son's favorite toys.
That's got to be Asheville, probably sprinting off to restart a scenario. She's wearing a speed screw, isn't she?
I don't know.
I do. I don't think we would have gotten this many hits on her with a patrol screw. Let's plot this out.
Running a plot. Already have some of it, another chief reported. The process was largely computer-aided now. Once it had been a real black art.
Posit? Jones looked up.
Position's right about here, same as the beacon, almost, sir. the chief said patiently, making a black mark on the plastic-covered wall chart. We know where she is. I mean, the rescue. Ain't gonna be no rescue.
Jones looked up and stole a cigarette from a passing seaman.
There. I finally said it out loud.
You can't smoke in here, one of the chiefs said. We have to go outside.
Give me a light and follow me on this, Jones ordered. He flipped another page, checking the 60 hertz line.
Nothing. Nothing. Those diesel boats are pretty good, but if they're quiet, they ain't snorting, and if they ain't snorting, they ain't going very far.
Asheville sprinted out this way, and probably then she came back in.
Another page.
No rescue, sir?
It had taken fully 30 seconds for the question to be asked.
How deep's the water?
I know that, but the escape trunks, I mean, I've seen it. There's 3 of them.
Jones didn't even look up, taking a puff off his first smoke in years.
Yeah, the mom's hatch. That's what we called it on Dallas.
See, Mom, if anything goes wrong, we can get out right here.
Chief, you don't get off one of these things, okay? You don't. That ship is dead, and so's her crew. I want to see why.
But we already have the crush sounds. I know. I also know that 2 of our carriers had a little accident today.
Those sounds were on the Sosa's printouts, too.
What are you saying?
I'm not saying anything.
Another page. At the bottom of it was a large black blotch, the loud sound that marked the death of USS Asheville, and all...
What the fuck is this?
We think it's a double plot, sir. The bearing's almost the same as the Asheville sound, and we think the computer... The time's off, goddammit, a whole 4 minutes.
He flipped back 3 pages.
See? That's somebody else.
Charlotte?
It was then that Jones felt even colder. His head swam a little from the cigarette, and he remembered why he'd quit. The same signature on the paper, a diesel boat snorting, and later a 688 class sprinting. The sounds were so close, nearly identical, and the coincidence of the bearing from the new seafloor array could have made almost anyone think, "Call Admiral Mancuso and find out if Charlotte's checked in. But right now, Senior Chief!"
Dr. Ron Jones stood up and looked around. It was the same as before, almost. The people were the same, doing the same work, displaying the same competence, but something was missing. The thing that wasn't the same was... What? The large room had a huge chart of the Pacific Ocean on its back wall. Once that chart had been marked with red silhouettes, the class shapes of Soviet submarines, boomers and fast attacks, often with black silhouettes in attendance, to show that Pacific SOSIS was tracking enemy subs, quarterbacking American fast attacks onto them, vectoring P-3C Orion ASW birds in to follow them, and occasionally to pounce on and harry them, to let them know who owned the oceans of the world. Now the marks on the wall charts were of whales, some of them with names, just as with Russian subs. But these names were things like Moby and Mabel to denote a particular pod with a well-known alpha pair to track by name. There wasn't an enemy now, and the urgency had gone. They were thinking the way he'd once thought, heading up north on Dallas, tracking people they might one day have to kill. Jones had never really expected that, not really. But the possibility was something he'd never allowed himself to forget. These men and women, however, had. He could see it. And now he could hear it from the way the chief was talking to Subpac on the phone. Jones walked across the room and just took the receiver away.
Bart, this is Ron. Has Charlotte checked in?
We're trying to raise her now.
I don't think you're going to, Skipper,
the civilian said darkly.
What do you mean?
The reply caught the meaning. The two men had always communicated on a nonverbal level.
Bart, you better come over here. I'm not kidding, Captain.
10 minutes. Mancuso promised.
Jones stubbed his smoke out in a metal waste can and returned to the printouts. It was not an easy thing for him now, but he flipped to the pages where he'd stopped. The printouts were made with pencils that were located on metal shuttle bars, marking received noises in discrete frequency ranges, and the marks were arranged with the low frequencies on the left and the higher ones on the right. Location within the range columns denoted bearing. The tracks meandered, looking to all the world like aerial photographs of sand dunes in some trackless desert.
But if you knew what to look for, every spidery trace and twist had meaning. Jones slowed his analysis, taking in every minute's record of reception, and sweeping from left to right, making marks and notes as he went. The chiefs who'd been assisting him stood back now, knowing that a master was at work, that he saw things they should have seen but had not, and knowing why a man younger than they called an admiral by his first name. "Attention on deck," some voice called presently. "Submarine 4 Pacific arriving." Mancuso came in, accompanied by Captain Chambers, his operations officer, and an aide who kept out of the way. The admiral just looked at Jones' face. "You raise Charlotte yet, Bart?"
"No. Come here." "What are you telling me, Jonesy?"
Jones took the red pen to the bottom of the page.
"There's the crush. That's the hull letting go."
Mancuso nodded, letting out breath.
"I know, Ron.
Look here. That's high-speed maneuvering."
"Something goes wrong, you go max power and try to drive her up to the roof," Captain Chambers observed,
not seeing it yet, or more probably not wanting to, Jones thought.
"Well, Mr. Chambers had always been a pretty nice officer to work for."
"But she wasn't heading straight for the roof, Mr. Chambers. Aspect changes here and here," Jones said, moving the pen upward on the printout page, backwards in time, marking where the width of the traces varied and the bearings changed subtly. "She was turning, too, at max power on a speed screw. This is probably a decoy signature. And this," his hand went all the way to the right, "is a fish. Quiet one. But look at the bearing rates. It was turning, too. Chasing Asheville, and that gives these traces here all the way back to this time point here." Ron circled both traces, and though separated on the paper by 14 inches, the shallow twists and turns were almost identical. The pen moved again upwards on the sheet, then shot across to another frequency column. "To a launch transient right here." "Fuck," Chambers breathed. Mancuso leaned over the paper sheet next to Jones, and he saw it all now.
"And this one?"
"That's probably Charlotte also maneuvering briefly. See? Here and here. Look like aspect changes on these traces to me. No transients, because it was probably too far away. Same reason we don't have a track on the fish." Jones moved the pen back to the track of USS Asheville. "Here. That Japanese diesel boat launched on her. Here, Asheville tried to evade and failed. Here's the first explosion from the torpedo warhead. Engine sound stopped here. She took the hit from aft. Here's the internal bulkheads letting go. Sir, Asheville was sunk by a torpedo, probably a Type 89, right about the same time that our two carriers had their little accident." "It's not possible," Chambers thought. When Jones turned his head, his eyes looked like the buttons on a doll's face. "Okay, sir, then you tell me what these signals denote." Somebody had to goad him into reality.
"Christ, Ron!"
"Settle down, Wally," ComSubPack said quietly, looking at the data and searching for another plausible interpretation. He had to look, even in the knowledge that there was no other possible conclusion. "Wasting your time, Skipper," Jones tapped the track of USS Gary. "Somebody better tell that frigate that it ain't a rescue she's on. She's sailing in harm's way. There's two SSKs out there with war shots, and they already used them twice." Jones walked to the wall chart. He had to search around for a red marker, lifted it, and drew two circles, both about 30 miles in diameter. "Somewhere here. We'll get a better cut on them when they snort next. Who's the surface track, by the way?"
"Reportedly a Coast Guard cutter, one of theirs heading in for the rescue," Subpack answered.
"We might want to think about killing it," Jones suggested, marking that contact in red also, then setting the pen down. He'd just taken the final step. The surface ship whose position he'd marked was not she, but rather it, an enemy, a target.
"We have to see Sinkpack," Mancuso said.
Jones nodded.
"Yes, sir, I think we do."
Chapter 22, The Global Dimension. The bomb was impressive. It exploded outside the Trincomalee Tradewinds, a new luxury hotel mainly built with Indian money.
A few people, none closer than half a block away, would remember the vehicle, a small white delivery truck that had been big enough to contain half a ton of AMFO, an explosive mixture composed of nitrogen-based fertilizer and diesel fuel. It was a concoction easily made up in a bathtub or laundry basin, and in this case sufficient to rip the facade off the 10-story hotel, killing 27 people and injuring another 100 or so in the process. Scarcely had the noise died when a telephone call came in to the local Reuters office.
"The final phase of liberation has begun," the voice said, probably reading the words off a prepared statement, as terrorists often did. "The Tamil Tigers will have their homeland and their autonomy, or there will be no peace in Sri Lanka. This is only the beginning of the end of our struggle. We will explode one bomb per day until we achieve our goal."
Click. For more than 100 years, Reuters had been one of the world's most efficient news services, and the Colombo office was no exception, even on a weekend. In 10 minutes, the report went out on the wire, a satellite link today, to the agency's London headquarters, where it was instantly relayed across the global news network as a flash story. Many U.S. agencies routinely monitor the newswire services, including the intelligence services, the FBI, Secret Service, and the Pentagon. This was also true of the White House Signals Office, and so it was that 25 minutes after the bomb went off, an Air Force sergeant put his hand on Jack Ryan's shoulder. The National Security Advisor's eyes opened to see a finger pointed topside.
"Flash traffic, sir," the voice whispered.
Ryan nodded sleepily, slipped off his seatbelt, and thanked God that he hadn't drunk too much in Moscow. In the dim lights of the cabin, everyone else was conked out. To keep from waking his wife, it was necessary to step over the table. He almost tripped, but the sergeant grabbed his arm.
"Thank you, ma'am."
"No problem, sir."
Ryan followed her to the spiral stairs and headed up to the communications area on the upper deck.
"What gives?"
He resisted the temptation to ask the time. It would have begged another question. The time in Washington, the time where the plane was now, or the time where the flash traffic had originated. Just another sign of progress, Ryan thought, heading to the thermal printer. You had to ask when now was. The communications watch officer was an Air Force first lieutenant, black, slim, and pretty.
"Good morning, Dr. Ryan. The National Security Office said to flag this one for you."
She handed over the slippery paper Jack hated. The thermal printers were quiet, though, and this communications room, like all the others, was noisy enough already. Jack read the Reuters dispatch, too new as yet to have any analysis from CIA or elsewhere.
"That's the indicator we were looking for. Okay, let's get a secure phone."
"Some other stuff has just come in," an airman said, handing over more papers. "The Navy had a bad day."
"Oh?"
Ryan sat down in a padded chair and flipped on a reading light.
"Oh, shit," he said next. Then he looked up.
"Coffee, please, Lieutenant." The officer sent an enlisted man for a cup.
"First call?"
NMCC, the senior watch officer. The National Security Advisor checked his watch, did the arithmetic, and decided that he'd gotten about 5 hours of sleep total. It was not likely that he'd get much more between here, wherever that was, and Washington.
"Line 3, Dr. Ryan, Admiral Jackson on the other end."
"This is Swordsman," Ryan said, using his official Secret Service code name. They tried to hang gunfighter on him, a token of backhanded respect for his earlier life.
"This is Switchboard. Enjoying the flight, Jack?"
It was a constant amazement to Ryan that the secure digital comlinks had such high transmission quality. He could recognize his friend's voice and even his humorous tone. He could also tell that it was somewhat forced.
"These Air Force drivers are pretty good. Maybe you should think about learning from them."
"Okay. What gives? What are you doing in the shop?"
"Pack Fleet had a little incident a few hours ago."
"So I see. Sri Lanka first," Swordsman ordered.
"Nothing more than the wire dispatch. We have some still photos, too, and we expect video in a half hour or so. The consulate in Trincomalee is reporting in now. They confirm the incident. One American citizen injured, they think, just one, and not real serious. But he's asking to be evac'd soonest. Mike is being painted into a corner. He's going to try and maneuver out of it when the sun goes down. Our estimate is that our friends are starting to get real frisky.
Their amphibs are still alongside, but we've lost track of that brigade. The area they've been using to play games in appears empty. We have overheads 3 hours old, and the field is empty. Ryan nodded. He slid the plastic blind off the window by his chair. It was dark outside. There were no lights to be seen below. Either they were over the ocean already, or there were clouds down there. All he could see was the blinking strobe on the aircraft's wingtip. Any immediate dangers there? Negative, Admiral Jackson thought. We estimate a week to take positive action, minimum, but we also estimate that positive action is now likely. The folks up the river concur, Jack, Robbie added. Admiral Dubrow needs instructions on what he can do about things, and he needs them soon. Understood. Ryan was making notes on an Air Force One scratch pad that the journalists hadn't managed to steal yet. Stand by. He looked up at the lieutenant. ETA to Andrews? 7.5 hours, sir. Winds are pretty stiff. We're approaching the Icelandic coast now. Jack nodded. Thank you. Robbie, we're 7.5 out. I'll be talking to the boss before we get in. Start thinking about setting a briefing up 2 hours after we get in. Roger that. Okay. Now, what the hell happened to those carriers? Supposedly, one of the Jap cans had a little malfunction and rippled off her Mark 50s. They caught both CBNs in the ass. Enterprise has damage to all 4 shafts. Dennis has 3 down. They report no fatalities, some minor injuries. Robbie, how the hell... Hey, swordsman, I just work here, remember? How long? 4 to 6 months to effect repairs. That's what we have now. Wait, stand by, Jack. The voice stopped, but Ryan could hear murmurs and papers shuffling. Wait a minute. Something else just came in. Standing by. Ryan sipped his coffee and returned to the task of figuring out what time it was. Jack, something bad. We have a sub-miss sub-sunk in Pack Fleet. What's that? USS Asheville. That's a new 688. Her BST-3 just started howling. Stennis has launched a bird to check it out, and the can's heading up there, too. This ain't good. What's the crew, like 100? More, 120, 130? Oh, damn. Last time this happened, I was a mid. We had an exercise going with them, didn't we? Dateline Partners, yes, just ended yesterday. Until a couple hours ago, looked like a good exercise. Things went in the shitter in a hurry. Jackson's voice trailed off. Another signal. First report, Stennis launched a Hoover. What? S-3 Viking, ASW bird, 4-man crew. They report no survivors from the sub. Shit, Jackson added, even though it wasn't exactly a surprise. Jack, I need to do some work here, okay? Understood. Keep me posted. Will do. Out. The line went dead. Ryan finished off his coffee and dropped the plastic cup into a basket bolted to the floor of the aircraft. There was no point in waking the president just yet. Durling would need his sleep. He was coming home to a financial crisis, a political mess, maybe a brewing war in the Indian Ocean, and now the situation with Japan would only get worse after this damn fool accident in the Pacific. Durling was entitled to a little good luck, wasn't he? By coincidence, Oreza's personal car was a white Toyota Land Cruiser, a popular vehicle on the island. He and his charter were walking toward it when 2 more just like it pulled into the marina's parking lot. 6 people got out and walked straight toward them. The former command master chief stopped dead in his tracks. He'd left Saipan just before dawn, having picked Burrows up at the hotel himself, the better to catch the tuna chasing their own food in the early morning. Though traffic on the way into the dock had been, well, a little busier than usual, the world had held its normal shape. But not now. Now there were Japanese fighters circling over the island, and now 6 men in fatigues and pistol belts were walking toward him and his charter. It was like something from a movie, he thought, one of those crazy TV mini things from when the Russians were real. "Hello? How was the fishing?" the man asked. He had O3 rank, Goreza saw, and a parachutist's badge on the left breast pocket, smiling just as pleasant and friendly as he could be.
I bagged one hell of an albacore tuna, Pete Burrows said, his pride amplified by the four beers he'd drunk on the way in. A wider smile.
Ah, can I see it?
Sure. Burrows reversed his path and led them back to the dock, where the fish was still hanging head down from the hoist.
This is your boat, Captain Oreza, the soldier asked.
Only one other man had followed their captain down. The others stayed behind, watching closely, as though under orders not to be too... something, Portigy thought. He also took note of the fact that this officer had troubled himself to learn his name.
"That's right, sir. Interested in a little fishing?" he asked with an innocent smile.
"My grandfather was a fisherman," the Ishii told them. Portigy nodded and smiled.
"So was mine. Family tradition.
Long tradition." Oreza nodded as they got to Springer.
"More than 100 years."
"Ah, a fine boat you have. May I look at it?"
"Sure. Jump aboard." Portigy went first and waved him over.
The sergeant who'd walked down with his captain, he saw, stayed on the dock with Mr. Burrows, keeping about 6 feet away from him. There was a pistol in the man's holster, a SIG P-220, the standard sidearm of the Japanese military. By this time, all kinds of alarm were lighting off in Ereza's brain.
"What does Springer denote?"
"It's a kind of hunting dog."
"Ah, yes, very good." The officer looked around. "What sort of radios do you need for a boat like this? Expensive?"
"I'll show you." Oreza led him into the salon.
"Your people make it, sir. NEC, a standard Marine VHF and a backup. Here's my GPS, nav system, depth finder, fish finder, radar."
He tapped each instrument. They were, in fact, all Japanese-made. High quality, reasonably priced, and reliable as hell.
"You have guns aboard?"
Click.
"Guns? What for?"
"Don't many islanders own guns?"
"Not that I know of." Oreza shook his head. "Anyway, I've never been attacked by a fish. No, I don't have any, even at home."
Clearly, the officer was pleased by that news.
"Oreza, what sort of name is that?" It sounded native to the Ishii.
"Originally, you mean. Way back, my people come from Portugal."
"Your family here a long time?"
Oreza nodded.
"You bet.
5 years was a long time, wasn't it? A husband and wife constituted a family, didn't they?"
"The radios. VHF, you say. Short range."
The man looked around for other instruments, but clearly there were none.
"Mainly line of sight, yes, sir."
The captain nodded.
"Very good, thank you. Beautiful boat. You take great pride in it, yes?"
"Yes, sir, I do."
"Thank you for showing me around. You can go now,"
the man said finally, not quite knowing how discordant the final sentence was. Oreza escorted him to the dock and watched him leave, rejoining his men without another word.
"What was Pete? You want to button it for a minute?"
The command was delivered in his master chief's voice and had the desired effect. They walked off to Ereza's car, letting the others pull away, marching as soldiers did to a precise 120 paces per minute, the sergeant a step to his captain's left and half a pace behind, walking exactly in step. By the time the fisherman got to his car, it was clear that yet another Toyota Land Cruiser was at the entrance to the marina parking lot, not really doing anything, but sitting there, with 3 men inside, all in uniform.
"Some kind of exercise? War games? What gives?" Burrows asked once they were in Oreza's car.
"Beats the shit out of me, Pete." He started up and headed out of the lot, turning right to go south on Beach Road. In a few minutes, they passed by the commercial docks. Portigy took his time, obeying all rules and limits, and blessing his luck that he had the same model car and color the soldiers used. Or almost. The vehicles offloading from Orchid Ace now were mainly olive green. A steady cab rank of airport buses offloaded people in uniforms of the same color. They appeared to be going to a central point, then dispersing, either to the parked military vehicles or to the ship, perhaps to offload their assigned units.
"What are those big boxy things?"
"It's called MLRS, Multiple Launch Rocket System.
There were six of them now, Areza saw. What's it for? Burroughs asked. Kid and people, Portugee replied tersely. As they drove by the access road to the docks, a soldier waved them on vigorously. More trucks, deuce and a halfs, more soldiers, maybe 500 or 600. Areza continued south. Every major intersection had a land cruiser in place, and no less than 3 soldiers, some with pistol belts, occasionally one with a slung rifle. It took a few minutes to realize that there wasn't a single police car in evidence. He turned left onto Wallace Highway. My hotel? How about dinner at my place tonight? Areza headed up the hill past the hospital, finally turning left into his development. Though a man of the sea, he preferred a house in high ground. It also afforded a fine view of the southern part of the island. His was a home of modest size, with lots of windows. His wife, Isabel, was an administrator at the hospital, and the home was close enough that she could walk to work if the mood suited her. The mood this evening was not a happy one. As soon as he pulled into the driveway, his wife was out the door.
"Manny, what's going on?"
Her ancestry was like his, short, round, and dark-complected. Now her swarthy skin was pale.
"Let's go inside, okay, honey? This is Pete Burroughs. We went fishing today."
His voice was calm, but his eyes swept around. The landing lights of 4 aircraft were visible to the east, lined up a few miles apart, approaching the island's 2 large runways. When the 3 of them were inside and the doors shut, the talking could start.
"The phones are out. I tried to call Rachel, and I got a recording. The overseas lines are down. When I went to the mall..."
"Soldiers?" Portugee asked his wife.
"Lots of them, and they're all..."
"Japs. Master Chief Quartermaster Manuel Areza, United States Coast Guard retired," completed the thought.
"Hey, that's not the polite way to..."
"Neither's an invasion, Mr. Burroughs."
"What?"
Areza lifted the kitchen phone and hit the speed dial button for his daughter's house in Massachusetts.
"We're sorry, but a cable problem has temporarily interrupted Trans-Pacific service. Our people are working on the problem. Thank you for your patience."
"My ass," Areza told the recording.
"Cable hell, what about the satellite dishes?"
"Can't call out?" Burroughs was slow to catch on, but at least this was something he knew about.
"No, it doesn't seem that way."
"Try this." The computer engineer reached into his pocket and pulled out his cellular phone.
"I have one," Isabel said. "It doesn't work either. I mean, it's fine for local calls, but..."
"What number?"
"Area code 617, Portugee said, giving the rest of the number.
"Wait, I need the USA prefix."
"It's not going to work," Mrs. Areza insisted.
"You don't have satellite phones here yet, eh?" Burroughs smiled. "My company just got us all these things. I can download on my laptop, send faxes with it, all that stuff. Here." He handed the phone over. "It's ringing." The entire system was new, and the first such phone had not yet been sold in the islands yet, a fact that the Japanese military had troubled itself to learn in the past week. But the service was global, even if the local marketing people hadn't started selling the things here. The signal from the small device went to one of 35 satellites in a low-orbit constellation to the nearest ground station. Manila was the closest, beating Tokyo by a mere 30 miles, though even 1 mile would have been enough for the executive programming that ran the system. The Luzon ground station had been in operation for only 8 weeks and immediately relayed the call to another satellite, this one a Hughes bird in geosynchronous orbit over the Pacific, back down to a ground station in California, and from there via fiber optic to Cambridge, Massachusetts.
"Hello," the voice said, somewhat crossly since it was 5 a.m. in America's eastern time zone.
"Rachel."
"Daddy?"
"Yeah, honey."
"You okay out there?"
his daughter asked urgently.
"What do you mean?"
"I tried to call Mom, but the recording said you had a big storm and the lines were down."
"There wasn't any storm, Rach," Areza said without much thought on the matter.
"What's the matter, then?"
"Jesus, where do I start?" Portugee asked himself.
"What if nobody..."
Was that possible?
Portugee, Burroughs said.
"What is it?" Areza asked.
"What's that, Daddy?"
his daughter asked also, of course.
"Wait a minute, honey. What is it, Pete?"
He put his hand over the receiver.
"You mean like invasion?
Like
War? Taking over? All that stuff?
Portigee nodded.
Yes, sir. That's what it looks like.
Turn the phone off now. The urgency in his voice was unmistakable. Nobody had thought any of this through yet, and both were coming to terms with it from different directions and at different speeds.
Honey, I'll be back, okay? We're fine. Bye.
Oreza thumbed the clear button.
What's the problem, Pete?
This isn't some joke, right? You're not doing a number to mess with my head, tourist games and all that stuff, are you?
Jesus, I need a beer.
Oreza opened the refrigerator and took one out. That it was a Japanese brand did not for the moment matter. He tossed one to his guest.
Pete, this ain't no play-acting, okay?
In case you didn't notice, we've seen at least a battalion of troops, mechanized vehicles, fighters, and that asshole on the dock was real interested in the radio on my boat.
Okay. Burroughs opened his beer and took a long pull.
Let's say this is a no-shitter. You can DF one of those things.
D.F.? What do you mean?
A pause while he dusted off some long unused memories.
Oh, yeah.
It was busy at the headquarters of Commander-in-Chief Pacific. SyncPAC was a Navy command, a tradition that dated back to Admiral Chester Nimitz. At the moment, people were scurrying about. They were almost all in uniform. The civilian employees were rarely in on weekends, and with a few exceptions, it was too late for them anyway. Mancuso saw the collective mood as he came through security, people looking down with harried frowns, moving quickly the better to avoid the heavy atmosphere of an office in considerable turmoil. Nobody wanted to be caught in the storm.
"Where's Admiral Seaton?" Comm Sub Pac asked the nearest yeoman. The petty officer just pointed to the office suite. Mancuso led the other two in that direction.
"Where the hell have you been?" SyncPAC demanded as they came into his inner office.
"Sosis, sir. Admiral, you know Captain Chambers, my operations officer. This is Dr. Ron Jones."
"The sonar man you used to brag on?"
Admiral David Seaton allowed himself a pleasant moment. It was brief enough.
"That's right, sir. We were just over at Sosa's checking the data on no survivors, but sorry, but the S-3 crew says..."
"Sir, they were killed," Jones interrupted, tired of the preliminaries.
His statement stopped everything cold.
"What do you mean, Dr. Jones?"
SyncPAC asked after perhaps as much as a second.
"I mean Asheville and Charlotte were torpedoed and sunk by Japanese submarines, sir."
"Now, wait a minute, son. You mean Charlotte, too?"
Seaton's head turned. "Bart, what is this?"
SubPAC didn't get a chance to answer.
"I can prove it, sir."
Jones held up the sheaf of papers under his arm. "I need a table with a light over it." Mancuso's face was pretty grim.
"Sir, Jonesy appears to be right. These were not accidents."
"Gentlemen, I have 15 Japanese officers in the operations room right now trying to explain how the fire control in their cans works, and..."
"Yeah, Marines, don't you?"
Jones asked coldly.
"They carry guns, don't they?"
"Show me what you have," Dave Seaton gestured at his desk.
Jones walked SyncPAC through the printouts, and if Seaton wasn't exactly a perfect audience, he surely was a quiet one. On further examination, the Sosus traces even showed the surface ships and the Mark 50 anti-sub-torpedoes that had crippled half of Packfleet's carriers. The new array off Kure was really something, Jones thought.
"Look at the time, sir. All of this happened over a period of, what, 20 minutes or so? You have 250 dead sailors out there, and it wasn't any accident."
Seaton shook his head like a horse shedding troublesome insects.
"Wait a minute. I haven't had any word. I mean, the threat board is blank. There aren't any indications at all that..."
"There are now, sir." Jones wasn't letting up at all.
"But, God damn it, Admiral," Jones swore. "Here it is, black and white, okay? There are other copies of this back at the Sosus building. There's a tape record, and I can show it to you on a fucking TV screen. You want your own experts to go over there? Well, shit, they're right here, ain't they?"
The contractor pointed to Mancuso and Chambers.
"We've been attacked, sir."
"What are the chances that this is some sort of mistake?" Seaton asked.
His face was as ghostly pale as the cloth of his undressed white uniform shirt.
Just about zero. I suppose you could wait for them to take an ad out in the New York Times if you want additional confirmation.
Diplomacy had never been Jones' strongest suit, and he was too angry to consider it anyway.
Listen, mister, Seaton began.